General Duncan, Reel 4.
You nonetheless returned to the tank corps within a few months in 1922. How did that come about?
I asked if it would be possible for me to go back to the tank corps. I did it through this parson who I knew, who said to his brother, there's a boy who I know who wants to go back to the tank corps, who's now serving the Black Watch. And in due course of time I went. And mark you, I was jolly sorry to go, because it was delightful being back with a regiment, especially a regiment like that. And there were a lot of people that I knew, and from the social angle, that's not really the right phrase, I mean, but from the domestic angle, it was delightful living with my own regiment and with my own friends. From the professional angle, from the soldiering angle, and by that time I was beginning to get jolly keen on soldiering, it was just absolute dead end. There was nothing there. Mm. And I knew that from my previous experience, I went to tank corps, there was a lot to do. A lot to learn, and my days were absolutely plumb full of interest from start to finish.
I remember when I read one of your letters, and you stress that from quite an early age, you'd always wanted to work with tanks. Yet as we've been talking, what's been coming across is the strength of your wanting to be in the tank corps, and that's different. It seemed not to, at this stage, have mattered to you whether it was service with armoured cars or service with tanks. You were in the tank corps. That was what the ambition was all about.
I think, in actual fact, that it was slightly qualified. It was slightly qualified to this extent that I'd achieved my ambition. I'd got to the people who handled tanks. The tanks as I got near them weren't quite as attractive as they were at the beginning. Their movement range, you see, was incredibly limited, and their speed was incredibly limited, and there didn't seem to be any prospect of that being improved at all. The armoured cars, which were part of the corps, were armoured, were mobile, had gun power, could be handled in a way which satisfied a great deal of the one's desire to have control of something which was a pretty formidable offensive weapon, properly handled under reasonable conditions. And I personally was quite content to wait. There was plenty of work for me to do, work which I could do and enjoy, and in due course of time, the tank situation would change, as it did.
Yes. Fine. Now, when you returned to Bovington in November of 1922, had many changes taken place since the period 2 years earlier when you'd been there?
Oh, yes. Very enormous changes.
Tell me about them, the things that struck you.
To begin with, the camp was quarter its size. You see, the 2nd, 3rd and 5th battalions had departed by then. I think I'm right in saying that. Yes, they had, and the depot battalion, which had been at Wareham when I left, was then in Bovington itself. The 4th battalion was they were in Bovington. Where the hell were they in Bovington? Oh no, the 4th Battalion were over at Wareham still. That was right. They were still there. They came back 3 years later, and the whole camp had got itself tidied up. There was married quarters. Officers' wives were living in the camp. The NAFI had begun to get itself organised. There was an air of there was some air of purpose about the place. The schools, central schools, they had settled down. They were under single control of the gunnery school at Lulworth and the driving maintenance school down here. And the classes were organised and tanks were moving about. The whole direction it ceased to be aimless. Bovington was going somewhere. I don't think it quite knew where it was going, but it was so quite definitely going somewhere. And there was a great deal of waste. The energies weren't really properly directed. We were still very much handicapped by a lot of very old men at the top who weren't all that much enterprising. The subalterns kept very firmly in their place. There were a lot of people who one would just as soon not have had there, but they were all right. It sounds quite dreadful, the good element. No, not quite that. The enterprising element was beginning to show its paces.
Were you able to judge where the new positive lead was coming from that you identified? In terms of personalities?
No, I don't think I could. Not in 1922. My impression in 1922 was that, as I say, a good deal firmer control had taken place. The part played by the depot in those early days, very interesting one. It was becoming a stabilising influence. It was commanded then by an old man called Moody, who was a Royal Scot, a first-class soldier, a very, very good and able and capable administrator. I don't think he was, in fact I know he wasn't a tremendous military brain, but he was a very sound, able soldier, and under his direction the depot was being pulled into some form of shape, and recruits were being given some training, not very good training, but nonetheless it worked, and they there were a very good lot of sergeant instructors there, first-class chaps.
You said the role of the depot battalion was very interesting. In what kind of ways did you mean?
In its product. I mean, after all, the chap shambled in to command the officer and said he couldn't get any work, and 16 weeks afterwards he walked out as a soldier, looking like a soldier, dressed like a soldier. It was fascinating.
When you came back to Bovington for the second spell, were you received as a trained tank corps officer, or were you treated as a new recruit and put through another training program?
You mean in 1922, when I came back? Oh, I was then sent down central. I did my two courses. I did a course in driving and maintenance on a Mark V tank, and I did a course at Lulworth covering the 6-pounder, Hotchkiss, and the Vickers gun.
Can we talk about this training, starting off with the driving and maintenance? Tell me about the course, the kind of experiences you had on it and the kind of skills you acquired. You said they were Mark Fives.
They were Mark Fives. They were the old Mark Fives. Over in Bovington, on the driving side, I was taught the whole internal construction of the engine, how it worked and why it worked, complete. Even down to the lighting system, the interior of the magneto, the interior of the autovac, which supplied the petrol, carburetors, the engine, which was the complicated one, gearbox and steering. And not only that, I was made to do a great deal of practical work. I was made to take out in that particular engine, you can take the valves out without moving from the engine. We had to do that. We had to retime magnets, we had to strip the carburetor, strip the autovac, adjust the steering, take out track links, tighten the track, adjust the epicyclic girl. All that sort of thing one did practically, as, and in addition to that, you drove the tank as well.
The driving element of the course, did that come as a surprise?
No, it came as no surprise. No, I never had any trouble with that. After all, I was a very, by that time I was a very experienced rails driver, because I drove rails whenever I could. Driving a tank is very much like riding a horse, it's a question of hands. And if you're in sympathy with the tank, it's easy to drive. That's really what it's about. The only trouble, of course, is with the Mark V, which was an incredibly heavy vehicle. It had an enormous amount of stuff on the ground. And the material which was used to make it wasn't all that good. It broke things. And very often, when you went down to drive, there wasn't anything to drive. And so you were driven back to revise your theoretical work or go and do something that somebody cocked up in the moment. It wasn't really very highly organized. There weren't any notes other than those which you took yourself and made up yourself. There were no handbooks that I remember. There must have been some. There were a number of section models. And you could really, by the time I'd finished, I was perfectly qualified as a tank driver. I'd driven enough. And really, you see, as far as the Mark V was concerned, once you lost your original fear of being up in the air, like, see, if you go over a 5-foot bank or 4-foot bank, you're rather like the man in the moon in the space shuttle. You're sort of stuck up like that, up level with the first story. And unless you're very careful, down she comes, just crash like that. On the other hand, you can let her down as gently as you like if you're control of the throttle. If you're sympathetic to the machine, you see, you can bring it down, so you will hardly crack an egg when it gets down. Now, on the other hand, if some stinker is annoyed you at the back, you bring it down with a bang and bump his head very nearly off.
I imagine that the provision for creature comforts within the tank were fairly limited to this time. Did you have to learn some kinds of techniques of bracing yourself or whatever in order to preserve body?
Well, that's the most crashing, unstable way. There were no provisions of any kind for any crew comfort. And if you were going to live in the crew, you would live on the sailing ship rule, one hand for the ship and one the other one for yourself. And the lot of the tank crew was a hard one in the extreme. No question about it. Tanks aren't comfortable even now.
Yes.
They're absolute miracles compared to what they were. This was just simply a plain steel box, unpadded, with an unbelievably hot and smelly engine in the middle of it, and an exhaust pipe against which you were liable to be thrown at any second, unless you'd taken precautions.
One thing which puzzles me is, given the limitations of the machine, the noise it made, the lack of internal wireless communications, one thing that always puzzles me is how, in fact, the tank crew ever managed to work as a crew at all.
I don't know. But you did. Because if you had a sufficiently forceful tank commander, you could always make yourself understood. Always. After all, he could talk to the driver who sat next to him. If he had any trouble with his crew at the back of the room, he merely got out and went down and bellowed at them until they did what he did want them to do. And really, in actual fact, you see, once you're shut up in that steel box and you're responsible for making the thing go, automatically every member of the crew is welded together. The crew really is the whole secret of the tank corps. This is the thing which has developed enormous patriotism and pride of regiment, Esprit de Corps. Four, five chaps, up to eight chaps, shut up in the steel box. Inside the tank, you can do anything. Inside, you're virtually all exactly on the same level. The moment your feet touch on the ground outside the march off from the tank, you go back to as rigid a form of discipline as you like to impose.
I can see how the tank commander could communicate with the driver, okay, since, as you say, he was sitting next to him, but what about communicating to brakemen and gearmen and people who
the brakeman, of course, had gone out just after the Battle of Cambrai, because you were back in a one-man drive tank. Their communication with the gearsmen was by a series of knocks on the engine cover. After all, as far as they were concerned, all that you wanted them to do was to put them in which either first gear, neutral, or second gear. And therefore, they had a code. I never actually served with those tanks. But as far as I remember, you banged once on the engine casing. So it was sort of bang, bang, bang. That meant neutral. And bang, bang meant first, and bang, bang, bang meant third, or second. But again, every tank commander, I think, had his own particular means. Mm-hmm. We indicated it by fingers. That was probably neutral, this was one, and that was two.
I have a nagging suspicion that your youthful image of the tank was a rather romanticised one. I imagine by the time you'd been through this course, it was rather different.
Disillusioned? Oh, no, not this. I don't think so. I don't think it was romanticised. No, it wasn't. In actual fact, when I came off the course, I had immense satisfaction. I'd learnt a great deal. That I was the master of the weapon, that was the important thing. I was perfectly prepared to take out anywhere then. That I knew, I knew all about it, really all about it. I'd been so thoroughly drilled. And I had been so thoroughly drilled without going back into the tank now, 50 years afterwards, I can still draw for you the necessary bits of the tank, not only how they work inside, but where they are on the outside.
What were the facilities like at the gunnery school at Lulworth?
The facilities at the gunnery school were they're indifferent at that time. There were gunnery huts where there were 6-pounder guns were stripped down. There were other huts where the guns were taught. There was one for the ammunition. There were no miniature ranges. There were fixed batteries of guns where you were stripped 6-pounders and that sort of thing. There were rooms full of the ordinary army huts were divided into two by partition. Either end would be used for gun drill or gunnery instruction, and you were there taught either the Vickers gun or the Hotchkiss gun. The ranges were there. You went out and fired a revolver on the ranges, you fired 6-pounder, and you fired Hotchkiss guns. Hotchkiss gun was an absolute stinker, beastly gun. It had the air cooled, and it was an adaptation of the cavalry gun. And the difference being is on the cavalry gun, the ammunition was supplied in a flat belt, flat strip, like that, about that long, 30 rounds. And like that, the Hotchkiss fired quite beautifully. But in the tank, there wasn't room for that long strip when you traversed the gun to the left. The end of the strip used to hit the side of the tank, and so they devised a special box and a linked metal belt, which gave stoppage after stoppage after stoppage. And again, in full pride of being a Rolls Vickers boy, I thought this was a beastly tin pot affair. As far as the Vickers gun was concerned, of course, I was absolutely unbeatable. I mean, I knew the Vickers gun inside out, a tripod drill and everything. So that I had enormous advantage as far as my squad was concerned. And the same thing, of course, applied over the driving maintenance.
Were you only trained at Lulworth on machine guns?
No, on the 6-pounder.
On the 6-pounder?
And you fired 6-pounder.
What kind of exercises did they have at the time? Training exercises?
There are no training exercises as such. They were purely range practices. Range practices fired either from a tank or from one of the standing batteries, which littered the place about. But they were quite adequate. It was as a recruit course for officers awaiting selection for the Royal Tank Corps. I think it was adequate. It wasn't inspiring. We taught the theory of sighting and that sort of thing, firing moving tanks and that sort of thing. That really hadn't sort of entered into it very much.
As regards the gunnery training, especially on the 6-pounder, was it both static and on the move?
Well, the actual training, the individual skill in the weapon, that was all done in a classroom. In a classroom, we later moved on to a tank to sort of realize what it was like. And then after that, yes, you did a certain amount with the tank moving. But you see, tank movement in those days was jolly near impossible. I mean, your track life was absolutely nothing. And it was nothing. And spares were very short. And if there's nothing, you find that six tanks ought to have been out in the range and only one there. The others had all broken down, either failed to start or broken down on the way to the range.
To the extent that there was any 6-pounder training on the move, what was your level of accuracy like?
Oh, frightful. Quite frightful. Solid track, no springs, and crouched down behind a gun, no, absolutely none. And for a long time, of course, we pursued the myth of accuracy on the move, which was all right as long as you got to the stage where you had superiority over any other nation as far as guns were concerned. And really, in those days, if you hit a tank anywhere, you knocked the thing out. So it's really firing at a target the size of a young haystack. And the inaccuracy didn't really matter so much at a range of 500 yards with a target of that size. And you see, this went on. It wasn't until the war started, really, that we began to appreciate the fact that there are only two absolute certain places that you want to hit the javelin. One is on the turret ring, so you can't traverse the turret. The other, better still, is at where the gun comes out of the turret. Either of those two, and he's in a dead duck, you can finish him off at your leisure. But you can't do that on the move. That demands absolute accuracy, which you only get at on stationary firing.
So given that at this stage you only had to hit the tank, then this made sense? Well, in that case, how would you estimate the possibility of hitting the tank anywhere on the move? Do you think you could manage it at this time?
This is an impossible question to assess because again, you're relying so enormously on the ability of the individual. This is gun coordination. This is going back to the thing I was talking about the free Vickers gun and the chap with a shotgun. Man who's good with a shotgun, he's likely to be better with a 6-pounder under those conditions than somebody who isn't. That's all you can say. And as far as the probability of a hit at 2 miles an hour, the trouble is that if 2 miles an hour, if you hit a thing the size of the tape recorder, the tank leaps up in the air about 2 feet and comes down with a crash on the other side. The only thing you're doing is you're kneeling on a steel plate. And it's jolly sore, not conducive to accurate fire.
How much attention was paid during this short training period at Bovington to the tactical use of tanks?
None. Absolutely none. It always was purely a driving maintenance course and purely a gunnery course.
Did anyone express any views as to what the role of the machines you were being trained to operate was?
Well, the role of the machine was quite clearly understood those days as a sport of infantry. Tempered by wild talk about bony fellows 1919 army, which was all armoured. But that was all.
Hmm. Have you any recollection where, under what circumstances, you first heard this wild talk?
Well, I think it was chances of 21. I was partially responsible. Yes, of course it was. It wasn't wild. It was. You see, my generation who came in who hadn't fought in tanks during the war. This was a sort of speculation, 12 o'clock at night and Club Pember, that sort of thing. After all, there are plenty of suggestive romances, H.G. Wells' War of the World, that sort of thing. Bernie Fuller, people knew about Bernie Fuller, lots of people, some of the intelligent chaps would talk about it, Horace Burke, that sort of ingenious mind. This was constant speculation on the use of the weapon. It all came back to the same thing. What you wanted was a faster tank, better sprung, better gun.
I was interested to know whether, in fact, at that time, subalterns actually read Bernie Fuller.
Well, I did.
Well, that's all. Just account for yourself.
Yes. Yeah, I can only speak for myself. The 2 o'clock club or 12 o'clock club, they speculated continuously. That's where they always say. In the intervals.
Yes.
One ordinary, normal interest. In time, the conversation swung back to shop, and it was said, "Why? What a pity! Why couldn't you?" There were a certain number of medium C's. You see, the medium C, which was the armament of the second tanks at Farnborough, was considerably faster than the Mark V, and it was moved up to about 8-9 miles an hour, more than that, 10, 12, I think. Life inside wasn't much fun, it was on the solid track, but I mean, you saw those things moving, and then and said, well, it's a pity you couldn't do. If we had 1,000 of those, or what would have happened to the Germans? And now it will start, you see. And somebody else says you're a fool, and they will say you're not. And then the argument is open to anybody, leaving both sides completely unconvinced of the soundness of the other's views.
Your duty as a depot officer was what?
A depot officer in charge of recruit squads. And in those days, as far as I remember, it took 16 weeks. The transformation was absolutely staggering. The chaps used to come in down at heel, badly fed, out of work, dispirited and broken. 16 weeks after, you would see the same man walking, going out to join a unit, clean and smart and tidy, with quite an amount of knowledge behind him. And what's much more, the beginnings of an inquiring mind into soldiering, which is really the whole secret thing from start to finish. I found it an interesting period. There were times of acute boredom. I really spent the whole morning down on an enclosed 30-yard range putting recruits through firing practice. The driver was nearly up the wall by lunchtime. On the other hand, there were enormous confrontations. The game was to play with the chaps, and they were fun. And the non-commissioned officers we had were beginning to be, some of the non-commissioned officer instructors, the absolute salt of the earth. We had a very good regimental sergeant major at that time. We had admirable company commanders. We had a mixed bag of subalterns, on the whole, pretty high standard. And
what about the standard of the recruits? Were you getting a good quality
man? The
standard
of recruits has always been high. We weren't allowed to have too many soldiers. Nobody wanted to make the tank or any bigger to dress them. And so the standard was put up. And so we got the job. We recruited men an inch higher, or 2 inches higher than the infantry did. Of course, going back to the war years, the chap who'd grown up to be 2 inches higher than these contemporaries was probably better fed, and therefore more intelligent. And we did a lot of intelligence work at that time. this really actually slightly overlaps into the next period when I came back as assistant adjutant. But this was the beginning of the psychological test, the aptitude test, which is now, of course, accepted practice. But I think we almost pioneered that, and we did it in order to select men for the trades which we wanted. By this time, of course, we'd gone on a lot further. The fast Vickers tank had come in, after what we now call the Vickers medium, which had a speed of 20 miles an hour, and a 3-pounder gun with all-round traverse.
What sort of impression upon the tank corps did the arrival of that particular machine have?
First of all, it revolutionised everybody's thoughts. And they thought, my God, we've now got sufficient speed to undertake operations independent of, but in conjunction with the infantry, and therefore you can fire your power. And, of course, the revolving turret made a hell of a difference. It meant you could concentrate your fire. And the speed, as I say, made a great difference. And then, of course, you began to strike the snags.
Such as
tracks and bogies were the first one. The original Vickers Mark I came out, and the bogies, you could see them, watch a battalion going down the road, and you would see the bogey wheels breaking off the